Council is setting up Alaska Marshall to call the next case.
Calling case number A231404, Capital Construction versus Nicholas Hanslick.
And good morning. Each of you, just some rules. Each of you has 15 minutes to present your case in chief. 5 minutes is additionally reserved for rebuttal to appellate counsel if you choose to use that. A reminder to please state your name and indicate which party you're speaking on behalf of before your arguments. And I think they have adjusted the podium. There is a button there. Go ahead and adjust it up or down to your height preference. Appellant counsel, when you're ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jason Zurich. I represent the appellants, Mr. and Mrs. Hanslick. I'm asking this court to reverse the trial court's judgment and order of judgment in favor of the respondents, Capital Construction, because the trial court erred in finding that the liquidated damages clause in this case was enforceable. It's a penalty. And it's determined, it can be determined to be a penalty based on the reasonableness of the amount agreed upon in looking at the surrounding circumstances as well as the nature of the damages contemplated.
Let me tell you where I am really confused, and I'm hoping both counsel can clarify this for me. We have a trial court, I'm talking about the burden of proof on liquidated damages. In Minnesota, the burden of proving liquidated damages damage clause as a penalty, and we disfavor that. But there's argument that the burden was shifted to your clients.
That was the...
I've got Gorko here. I've read N. Ray Bowles. I'm trying to figure it out. Who has the burden? Who has the burden of disproving that? It looks as if it's a presumption on the liquidated damages clause, and then it would be your client's obligation to overcome that presumption.
Well, my understanding, Your Honor, is that this court decided that issue in Lagoon Partners 999 NW 2D113 in 2023, indicating...
Right, enlighten me, what did we say, and who said it?
It was reaffirming Gorko,
okay,
stating that Gorko stood for the proposition that the burden of reasonableness is on the proponent of the clause, the individual that's trying to enforce it.
On the reasonableness of the liquidated damages.
The reasonableness who of the burden is on to prove the reasonableness of the damages is on the proponent of the clause. So the district court first erred in finding that it was on the appellants, the Hanslicks, to prove reasonableness and then put the burden on them to produce evidence, which they noted that the Hanslicks didn't produce any evidence. However, that would be relying on the burden being on the Hanslicks to prove the reasonableness. Despite that...
So if we agree with you and we would then reverse and remand to the district court to redetermine based on the burden shifting, you then have another chance then to stand on your merits. I know there wasn't any testimony by your clients. The testimony was two exhibits and a principal for the respondent company. Is that the way you see this playing out?
Well, I understand that this court could just reverse the trial court and order judgment consistent with the opinion of this court.
Would we not then be weighing evidence?
I'm not sure you'd have to weigh evidence, as the facts in the record indicate that the damages in the liquidated damages clause that's being litigated in this case, each element or service indicated in that clause can be determined by time and money. So it's ascertainable, and I have not found a case where court has upheld a liquidated damages clause when the damages have been able to be determined. And you can look at each of those elements. They can be measured in time and dollars.
But if time and dollars is implemented, I'm sorry, I forgot the individual's name, Mr. Bergerson. Didn't Mr. Bergerson testify that time and money exceeded the amount of the allotment for the windows?
He testified to that, but he didn't substantiate that with anything, Your Honor. I mean, he didn't provide any time cards, dates, and when those hours were. There was another project that was involved in this.
Under your theory, as far as resolution, we would simply reverse and say the burden shifting was wrong. It can be time and manner determined. They didn't present evidence. They fail.
That and the trial court judge also found that the price was infirm, even though Mr. Bergerson testified that the services can be determined in time and money. So I think just on the clause alone, this court could rule that that clause is not enforceable because it's de novo review. It's a legal determination. That clause is not enforceable.
Do you have the page number for Lagoon where that proposition on the burden shifting? I had the same questions as Judge Werke about why wouldn't we just do a straight remand with the proper burden to be considered? And in my skimming this, I'm not finding that proposition.
Okay, I would look, I believe it's at 117.
Okay. I'll reread the, I don't want to take up your time.
You can
certainly
during your time before rebuttal, you can address that if you wish during your time.
And I believe I did cite that in my brief as well. On page 16, and that was taken from Gorko, and then I think reused in Lagoon. So I can certainly find that and update the court on rebuttal. But as we analyze the liquidated damages clause, I think it's a legal determination on whether or not it's enforceable. And if those damages can be determined, it's not enforceable. And here we have a situation where no work was performed and they're trying to claim 25%.
Although Mr. Bergerson testified that he did all sorts of things, went here, looked at windows, looked at this, made email contacts, so you're disputing the testimony that was elicited at trial?
Saying it's insufficient. That would be the Hanslick's first notice of any type of time spent on doing, sending emails and whatnot. I think if the court closely looks at the plaintiff's evidence of the losses that are actually caused by the Hanslick's, it's diminished. It's the damages that are general administrative costs, and that, again, without proof they increase the damages are insufficient to sustain a liquidated damages clause. So I think if by reviewing the liquidated damages clause, you can see it does not relate to the actual damages involved in this case. And I think the court needs to look at it at the time the contract was entered into and not at the time that this case was litigated. Because if at the entering into that contract, it would guarantee the capital construction 25%, whether or not they do any work whatsoever.
But the test for the validity of a liquidated damages clause looks at whether the damages are reasonably calculated. And so, or could be reasonably calculated. So I don't understand how we wouldn't look at it at the time of the litigation, because we have to figure out what did they do and can you reasonably calculate those damages?
But in determining whether or not those damages can be ascertainable, you have to look at the beginning of the contract.
We look back to the contract itself, sure, but we have to look at what happened since they signed the contract.
And in this case, there is trial testimony. Mr. Bergeron said that he spent hours sending emails, but there's no dates, no time cards, no invoices for that. If he wanted to charge for emails and administrative tasks, he could have put that in the contract.
Here's what we're looking at. I'm sorry. We're looking at a specific finding by the trial court that Mr. Bergeron testified credibly. And he did testify about things that you're now saying were de minimis. But we do have the judge saying that he testified credibly. How do we overcome that?
And the judge says he testified credibly that the items or services under the liquidated damages clause are reasonable in light of what they would get as far as a profit in a normal project. And I think if you look at the trial court's decision, it's based on a price being infirm, but that's not the test. It's got to be non-ascertainable. And Mr. Bergeron did testify that all those elements or all those services may be measured in time. If there would have been a clause directing that the Hanslicks had to pay Capital Construction at an hourly rate for negotiating with the insurance contractor, they would have to obviously substantiate that with time cards. The Hanslicks never received anything regarding these additional hours until trial when Mr. Bergeron testified that there was hours, many, many hours. So I want to touch on the Mr. Bergeron's testimony. He did indicate that they enter into a contract without an understanding of the price. But he also submitted an affidavit stating that we do know how many hours in advance of a project it's going to take. So he contradicted himself at the trial court. I don't know how he becomes credible when I was able to elicit testimony that he filed an affidavit stating one thing and then stated something else at trial. I believe the Capitol is going to argue that was a mistake. I believe they noted that in their brief, but I would hold to the court that it is a signed affidavit. And I don't believe that Capital sufficiently proved what their actual damages were. If they were able to put forth time cards, statements, dates, times of when alleged work was done, or these administrative tasks of sending emails or phone calls, they would be able to substantiate those actual damages. But here they haven't. They've only stated that spent many, many hours. And I think it's important that Capital didn't perform any of those services under the liquidated damages clause. So I'm asking this court to reverse the judgment of the trial court, enter judgment in favor of the Hanslicks. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll hear from respondent counsel.
Okay, I see an up and down button, but I don't know where it is.
It should be like center below the podium there.
Oh, okay, thank you. Good morning to the panel. May it please the court. I am Catherine Wagner. I represent the respondent, Capital Construction LLC, in this matter. We are here asking you to affirm the trial court's findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order for judgment of July 31st, 2023, and the subsequent judgment entered on August 1st, 2023. I would like to get right to...
Before you get to the issue, I mean, the issue is my concern is who had the burden of proof under the liquidated damage clause. And as your opponent pointed out in Lagoon, this court tried to clarify Gorco. I've read Gorco. I can't make heads or tails out of Gorco. But this court did say that the proponent of a liquidated damage clause, that would be your client, bears a burden of introducing evidence to justify the liquidated damage clause. We have a district court judge at paragraph 12 of its order that indicated it was the debtor's burden.
Well, I think, Your Honor, that might be something that needs to be clarified by this court, because that's contrary to everything I've read. So I'm reading from the practice series here, and I'll cite the case law if that's okay. That's where I wanted to start.
Right. Are you saying that Lagoon is interpreting this incorrectly, or are you saying the district court did?
I would say Lagoon. I'll be candid that I'm not the most familiar with that case, but I can cite to all the case law that would say otherwise, if that's all
right. That's what I'm asking you to do. I'm just really hung up on that point. Thank you. I would appreciate it.
So a liquidated damages clause is prima facie valid, and the presumption of validity can be rebutted with evidence that the clause was not intended as a fair compensation, but instead a penalty. And I think just that alone, it logically follows that the proponent wouldn't be presenting rebuttal evidence. But that comes from, that's from Dean Van Horten Consulting Associates Incorporated versus Wold, 395 Northwest 2nd, 407 through 408. That's this court's opinion of 1986. And we also have a C to Gamma Lending Omega LLC versus Talon First Trust LLC, which is a Westlaw opinion from this court of 2019. And in that case, it says, the burden is on the party challenging the liquidated damages clause to demonstrate that it is an unenforceable penalty. And that is citing Gorco at 74, Penn site 74, and then in reference to the Eighth Circuit in Rebolsa Parcel. And so whatever is said in Lagoon Partners, I just think wouldn't logically follow. Because if that was the case, then every contractor with a clause like this would be forced to constantly defend its own clause.
That's my concern. I feel like we've lost some common sense, yeah. And I don't necessarily find harmony with all of these cases. So I'm trying to find an answer.
Well, I hate to say the forest for the trees thing, but I've been doing a lot of research for this, and I think that when we're talking about liquidated damages provision, we really just need to focus on reasonableness. And, you know, Gorco, I have this set out because I think it's stated very clearly, because Gorco adopts the restatement of contracts, but it doesn't. That's not the whole issue. Before it adopts a restatement of contracts with these two factors, it very and inconspicuously says, in determining the issue, neither the intention of the parties nor the expression of intention is the governing factor. The controlling factor, rather than the intent, is whether the amount agreed upon is reasonable or unreasonable in light of the contract as a whole, which is a factual issue, which is why this is not just subjected to no overview. Anyways, the nature of the damage is contemplated and the surrounding circumstances. Then it says, the law adopts as its guiding principles, that the injured party is entitled to receive a fair equivalent for the actual damages necessarily resulting from failure to perform the contract and no more. So in that sense, it needs to be compensatory. It's a penalty if it's not compensatory. It's a penalty if it's punishing you for non-performance or forcing you to perform. And that's just not the case at all with these facts. And the court made that clear in its findings, excuse me, in order, in conclusions of law.
There is evidence in this record that shows Mr. Bergensen testified about a profit of 15%, and he put a number on that, and that's on page 30 of the transcript. If that's true, that he was able to calculate what the profits would have been, why is it not reasonable to calculate these numbers or possible?
Well, I think that becomes a misstatement of law, which I noticed in appellant's brief. So Gorko and none of the case law says that if if it is capable of definite determination, that's it, that it's void. And that's actually what's said in appellant's brief. And that's, I have a direct, if you give me a second, I can tell you a case law that says that that's not the case. Then it becomes a question of proportionality. And actually, if I can just run over here, in appellant's brief, he cites to this from Gorko. On the other hand, when the measure of damages resulting from the breach of contract is of definite measurement, we have uniformly held an amount greatly disproportionate to be a penalty. And so there's actually, what that cites to is J.I. Case Threshing Mock Co. versus Franck, 145 Min, 3941. 1908, it's the older opinion. But it says, if the particular elements of loss or damage be given and the actual loss in those respects may be definitely ascertained and shown by evidence, an amount greatly disproportionate thereto will be, as a general rule, treated as a penalty. And as Mr. Bergensen testified and as the court reiterated in its findings, the liquidated damages in this case was far less than the contractual damages under common law breach. So I think that's really where we're kind of getting lost here, is about whether or not this is reasonable. I took some notes here. I wanted to address a couple things. So no proof of actual damages is required, and that's clear by the case law.
So I agree with you that that doesn't end the analysis of that. If it could be calculated, that's not the end of the analysis. But but when we're comparing what profits would have been at about $4,800 compared to the $20,000 that was awarded here, when you add in the attorney's fees, it does start to look a bit disproportional.
I guess I'm confused by that, because that wasn't how I understood it. So what I remember Mr. Bergensen saying was that normally they would get their costs, and in his affidavit attached to the response to the motion to dismiss, he said that they spent approximately, I think it was 150 hours at $100 an hour. That right there would be $15,000. So that would be the cost. And normally they would get a profit of 15% of the insurance award, the RCV. So that right there, I did the math of that, would be about 4,000 something of the window award. And so that would put you closer to 20,000.
I understand.
It's not disproportionate, because it's only 7,000 under the liquidated damages. So it's disproportionate on the lower end, but not being more, if that makes sense.
Got it. So the testimony about lost profits is only one consideration, and then you have to actually add in the costs and the work and some other things.
Yeah, and I think the focus is about the compensatory nature of it. I mean, it's the appellant says multiple times that the capital did no work, there was no work done, and that's what the court said in Gorko, because with that contract for the garages, it was like the next day the person that signed the contract for the garages got another company to do it. That wasn't the case here. We had years, I mean, months and months and months, because first the roof was done, and then there was a pause because there was this back and forth, which Mr. Bergeson testified to about which windows we're going to put here. And, you know, it's the insurance company might approve one window and not the other. And so there's a lot of work going back and forth. And so it's just unequivocally false that Capital didn't invest time in advance or labor in this. The labor was providing estimates, which is cited in the damages clause. It's going out and taking pictures and things of that nature. And also, I just want to speak to, you know, the first argument would be that, you know, this wasn't clear, right? When Capital goes into it, a contract like this, they don't know if the insurance company is going to approve it. Not only that, they don't know if they're going to have to fight it and do an adjustment, you know, arbitration. None of those things can be preconceived at the time of contracting. So I think if we just focus on the reasonableness of this and the facts, which Capital presented testimony and also the contract itself and the adjustment award, which the district court said was the best indication of the terms of the liquidated damages clause itself. And then you take the fact that the plaintiff provided no contravening testimony, no evidence. I think that says a lot. And so, I mean, really, I think the burden is fairly was on the Hanslicks to show that this this liquidated damages clause was in fact a penalty, and they provided none. And now they're here arguing that the district court in some way was wrong as a matter of law. They've made no argument that the district court made. I suppose just now I heard counsel saying that though the district court found Mr. Bergeson's testimony credible, it just wasn't sufficient because it wasn't supported by evidence. I don't think that would be enough to find clear error by the district court. And the weight of the evidence would support the court's conclusion and order. So, just address one more thing. Oh, I I don't know if this is really worth addressing. It is addressed in our brief pretty thoroughly, but any suggestion that Mr. Bergeson's testimony is not credible because there's one grammatical error in his affidavit saying that he knew going into it how much work this was, I think that's just, I would ask the court to not be persuaded by that. I understand we do have a duty to make sure that our writings are clear. If you look at the whole affidavit, it says we do not know. And then there's one that says, we do know. And then his testimony says, we do not know. I would say the weight of that would contradict any argument and any finding that the district court made it was clearly erroneous in finding Mr. Bergeson's testimony credible. So I also just want to make note that the Hanslicks did not file any post-trial motion for amended findings or for a new trial. And so the scope of review here, along with the standards of review, would have to be limited to whether the evidence of the district court sustains the finding of fact and whether such findings sustains the conclusion of law on the judgment. And I would argue, we argue that they failed to do that. They failed to show that the trial court's findings are palpably and manifestly against the weight of the evidence, and nor can they show that the trial court's conclusions of law are not sustained by its findings.
I had a question about that. I wasn't going to ask it, but since you brought it up, is that still the valid scope of review after the Supreme Court's decision in Dupree?
You may very well be correct, Your Honor. I do not know.
Okay, because the U.S. Supreme Court recently said that a post-trial motion is not required to preserve a pure legal issue. So I wasn't sure whether that would still be this proper scope of review. Because normally I would agree with you, but then okay. I looked at that case.
Thank you, Your Honor. So in conclusion, Capital is again restate its request that this court affirm the district court's ruling, its finding of fact, conclusion, law, and order of July 31st, and its judgment entered August 1st of 2023.
Thank you, Ms. Ann. Thank you for appearing. I can tell you're under the weather.
Yeah, I have two kids in daycare.
With that said, Mr. Zerzik, you have the last word.
Thank you.
I just wanted to follow up on the quote in Lagoon Partners 99NW2D 113 at 124. It'd be the paragraph beginning with second. It's the last sentence that states, the Gorko opinion demonstrates that the proponent of liquidated damages clause bears the burden of introducing evidence to justify the liquidated damages clause. So I would believe that would be an error in law. Even, you know, Gorko is, I believe, from the 40s, 1940s, and that law has been around for some time. Again, when the damages are contemplated here, it's looking at a construction contract. Contractors all the time issue bids for work that are going to occur. So if I'm going to do your roof, I can go up and measure how many squares it is. I can determine the price for the shingles. Usually with my knowledge and experience, I'd be able to tell you how long it's going to take. And I believe that that type of work can be determined by normal damages, the amount of time that they spent doing the actual work. So based on the error in law and finding that the damages are ascertainable, but still enforcing the liquidated damages clause, I'm asking this court to reverse the trial court and issue an order for judgment for the Hanslicks. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for appearing today and for coming to our Capitol chambers. That is the last case that we have on our oral argument calendar. We do have other cases for consideration. This court will stand in recess.
All rise.